In an ordinary Sydney suburb, a family lives unnoticed.
You came across so innocent.
Father and son keep mostly to themselves.
We didn't go beyond the friendly nod or hello.
But behind closed doors...
Something's gone wrong. Big time.
If you don't make phone calls, nobody can tap you.
A new three-part series investigates how the road to Bondi began long before the first shots rang out. The Road to Bondi. Search Background Briefing wherever you get your podcasts.
ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
The prosecution says there is clear evidence to convict Joseph Ocone and Steve Fabrizi of the murder of Irma Palasik. The defence says they're the victim of a closed-minded investigation and a compromised crime scene. These are the closing statements that have been put to the jury. I'm Stephen Stockwell. Welcome to episode 10 of The Case of the Two Intruders.
Irma Palasik's brutal murder rocked her family and has haunted them for 24 long years.
This wasn't the average robbery.
The brutality of the attack shocked the community.
They were virtually tortured that night.
Violently assaulted before the two men ransacked the premises and stole cash and jewellery.
My grandparents were beaten and my grandmother was left to die on the lounge room floor.
For 8 weeks, the jury has listened to so much evidence. There have been 14 statements and recordings, 53 witnesses, 97 exhibits put before them, and we're now into the closing moments of this trial. There through all of it has been ABC Canberra court reporter Elizabeth Byrne. Liz, lovely to have you here and with us through this whole trial.
Thanks, Stocky.
And as well as Elizabeth, we're also very lucky to have investigative reporter James Viver with us on the pod as well. James, thank you for being here.
Hi, Stocky.
Liz, before we dive into basically our penultimate episode of The Case of the Two Intruders, can you give us an idea of where we're up to in 60 seconds or so?
Well, this week, the end is nigh. It's now over to the jury to decide if Steve Fabrizi and Joseph Ocone are guilty of the murder of Irma Palasik. And in Mr. Ocone's case, whether he was involved in the earlier burglary at the Palasik's former home when Mrs. Palasik pulled a balaclava from a man who punched her as he tried to escape. Justice David Mossop has acknowledged the jury has a complex task, not just to sift through the great volume of evidence, but also to make a decision hampered by the passage of time, with key witnesses now dead. The question is, will they be able to answer the question, who killed Irma Palasik?
Thank you, Liz. Yeah, this is a really crucial moment of the trial. I mean, how big a moment are the closings in a trial like the one that we've just been sitting through and reporting on?
Well, apart from the verdict at the end, this is the most critical moment. And it's where the prosecution and the defence lawyers, two in this case, get to nail their colours to the mast and put to the jury what they think has happened in the case, for the prosecution to say, this is how this unfolded, this is who is responsible, and to summarise the evidence that they've already presented. For the defence, it's an opportunity to criticise or try to tear down what the prosecution has put to defend their client and to suggest that they're not guilty of the crime that has been alleged.
Yeah. James, what was the mood in the courtroom like as they started earlier this week?
Yeah, look, it was pretty tense at the very beginning. Justice Mossop told the jury that the evidence they will hear are a bit like a set of ingredients. And so if that's the case, this is now sort of the finished dish. The public gallery of the courtroom was pretty much full to the brim. There was really only a few seats spare. There were many of the police officers that have given evidence during the trial. Certainly Craig Marriott was there with some of his colleagues. A lot of Irma and Gregor's family were there. A lot of journos like us.
Liz, can you remind us what Joseph Ocone and Steve Fabrizi have been charged with here? What the jury is deciding whether or not they're guilty of?
Well, both have been charged with murder. They've also been charged with a series of other things. For instance, the burglary, the assaults on the two people in the house. They have a lot of alternative charges as well. So, for instance, the burglary charges are aggravated burglary because they were said to have had a weapon. Mm. There's an alternative to that if the jury decides they didn't have a weapon, which was supposed to be the big stick that you may remember Gregor Palasik mentioned. So there's that. The important thing about these charges is that with the murder charge, they're accused of murder by joint commission. So they'd agreed to come to Canberra to commit a burglary. And in a circumstance like that, if you've made an agreement to do that crime and then someone is killed in the process of it, if it wasn't necessarily you that did that, then you are still responsible, as we discussed in an earlier episode. Mm. So that's the main thing they're confronting. It's also important to note that Mr. Vacconi is also facing some additional charges where it's alleged he was involved in an earlier burglary at the Palasik's former house. Mm. And you'll remember that's when Irma Palasik pulled the balaclava from his head. Steve Fabrizi has pleaded guilty to one charge. That's a charge of burglary.
Yep. Thank you, Liz. Yeah, admitting that he was at the Palasik's home in 1999, but saying he is not guilty of any of the other associated offences with him at that house at that time. We have the prosecution taking us through their closing first as these things unfold in the courtroom, spelling out the case, kind of tying together the threads of 2 months' worth of evidence. And it really starts to paint a picture, and you really start to learn kind of the reason you heard from certain people and certain facts were presented and certain questions were asked throughout. What did Trent Hickey, the prosecution barrister, ask the jury to think about, Liz?
He sort of set the scene. The Palasik's there at home, the lights on, the television on, two relatively older people in their 70s. And then these two intruders came into the house as per Gregor Palasik's evidence. They were beaten, they were tied up, they were gagged. And Trent Hickey tried to sort of convey what all of that meant, how that would have felt, so that the jury would be able to see the circumstances as they unfolded.
James, what stuck with you about the way that Trent Hickey presented a bunch of this information?
For me, it absolutely was the violence involved. It was the injuries caused as a result of the violence. Trent Hickey described to the jury how the Crown case says that the two men, the accused, were prepared for violence to happen, and therefore this is how it fits the charge of murder, this recklessness around human life. You know, they had the cable ties, they had the tape, they had the Jimmy bar or the big stick, as Gregor described it, as Liz mentions. And he stepped through a long list of the quite savage, really, injuries that were alleged to have been caused to this 73-year-old couple. They both had a broken nose. They were beaten around the head and body, and that brutality, whoever did it, whatever the jury decides, was very much hung in the court during those descriptions.
And it's important to note also that Trent Hickey pointed out several times that it appears they had contemplated using force because they had the cable ties and they had the tape with them. So this points to some key differences between the cases. Mm. So the prosecution says that, you know, he must have seen Mrs. Palasik's when he came into the house on his account, whereas Mr. Fabrizi's lawyer says there was a open door that might have obscured his view, so he wouldn't have seen her because he maintains he didn't see her.
Yeah, got it. Looking forward to unpacking the defence closings as we work through this episode as well, because there's so much in the closings from Travis Jackson and Sky Jerome, the defence barristers as well. In our last episode, we talked a lot about this potential third intruder. This is an idea that's been presented by the defence through this trial. You know, has the police investigated this properly? Had they looked into whether or not there was a third person involved in this, or even other people? I found it interesting how Trent Hickey kind of hit at these theories. You know, Liz basically saying, well, look, the money doesn't really add up.
Yes, well, we know that $30,000 was taken from the hidden compartment. And Steve Fabrizi has admitted he got $12,000 out of that. Now, if there was a third person, according to Trent Hickey, that would have meant that the the people who did the work of, you know, stealing the money would have got a much smaller portion because Joseph Ocone would have had to share the remaining $18,000 with whoever the third person was. So he said that didn't stack up.
Yep, yep. Also, you know, we've heard so much from this undercover recording with a guy called UCO Danny, undercover officer Danny. How was that brought into the closings from Trent Hickey, James?
Yes, that was recapped, and Trent Hickey had obviously gone through the transcript with the fine-tooth comb and run some of the numbers, helpfully, for the jury in asking them to consider this quite crucial piece of evidence. It was a very long recording. It was with this supposed crime boss that was a part of an operation that had ensnared Steve Fabrizi to work for this fake crime syndicate. And this was the crescendo, the coda, if you like, of this operation, during which time Steve Fabrizi denied ever having been to Canberra. And Trent Hickey said 17 times was how many times he denied. And in fact, lied about this, because we now know it to be true, because if nothing else, he's pleaded guilty to burglary as part of this incident in 1999. Trent Hickey said that Fabrizi's account changed three times and that it contradicted himself, and accused him of only being willing to say as much as he thought he needed to say in that time to get him out of the, quote, bind he was in. The way that Trent Hickey asked the jury to consider, or the way he characterized this theory of Fabrizi only being the lookout and that he hadn't gone in the house, was that it was ambitious and respectfully should be rejected. And he described it also as unreal and having been a construct of the defense case to give the accused cleaner hands.
Yeah, interesting. I mean, we know, and we've spoken so much about the DNA evidence in this trial. You know, the evidence that the prosecution says places Joseph Ocone and Steve Fabrizi at the Plasics home in 1999 is, you know, high likelihood DNA results that match their DNA from a water jug and a milk bottle from the Plasics fridge. DNA is such complicated evidence. We have heard days and days through this trial of, you know, the various likelihoods, the various tests. How did Trent Hickey try and tie all this up so the jury could understand it, Liz?
Well, basically, he relied upon the maths. So he went to the figures for the likelihood that the DNA on the milk bottle belonged to Steve Fabrizi, 312 quintillion times more likely to be him than anyone else. And with Mr. Vacconi's DNA on the water bottle, you know, 61 sextillion times more likely to be him. We already know from earlier in the trial, the DNA experts stop at 100 billion when they're talking about these probabilities, because otherwise, you know, it gets lost in the maths. But Mr. Hickey went to these extremely large figures to show that the probability was so high that there was no other plausible explanation for their DNA being on the two vessels in the fridge.
Yeah, absolutely. Was there a dramatic kind of flourish for Trent Hickey as he wrapped up his closing?
Yes, there was, Stocky. Trent Hickey went into sort of quite a long I think it was a very long sentence, actually, to the jury. But he said, you know, the two people who'd been in the house weren't to know that Mr. Palasics would survive and call the police. They weren't to know that he saw one of them drink from something in the fridge, which is how the police got onto the DNA evidence, that the crime scene investigators would swab things in the fridge even, that the police would see that the two burglaries might be linked. He went on and on with all of these things because the critical bit being, they weren't to know that technology would advance so far that their DNA would eventually be isolated and linked to them. So he set himself up to summarise the bulk of his case in one go, but he said he also asked the jury to consider the way in which Gregor Palasics found his wife. He And he kept saying a number of times through the closings that the tape had been wrapped very tightly around her head and that there seemed to be more than one layer. And he said that the only reasonable conclusion was that these two men were guilty.
Yeah, yeah. As well as the prosecution closing, you also have the defence closings as well. So I often find myself in courtrooms in this moment kind of leaning one way because I haven't heard the defence closing yet. And then I hear the defence closing and I start thinking of all these things that actually hadn't entered my mind at this point. We have Travis Jackson. He is Joseph Ocone's barrister. And he started reminding the jury in his closing of the burden of proof for the charges that Joseph Ocone is facing. Yeah, beyond reasonable doubt is the bar that the jury needs to reach. And he's pointed out that there's, you know, basically what there was no evidence of. You know, this says there was no evidence of criminal agreement. There was no specific evidence of the act. There was no evidence the car was in Canberra. And then he gets to the DNA, which, as we mentioned, crucial part. How did he challenge this?
Well, he suggested that the police had been seduced by the allure of DNA evidence. And that's because he said the police didn't look elsewhere. They didn't test anyone else. They only looked at the DNA of Mr. Facconi and Mr. Fabrizi. And that the important thing being that even with the maths, the best a DNA expert can say is that a person can't be excluded as being the source of a particular sample, rather than to say this is definitely that person. That's because not everyone in the world has been tested, so we can't say for absolutely sure that a sample belongs to a particular person. It's a question of probability, but that's one of the things he relied on.
And he said it was DNA or bust for the police in terms of their approach. And he said that the descriptions of Irma in 1998 and Gregor in 1999 of the intruders that had come into their two separate houses in those incidents could not be harmonised with the DNA evidence.
I was also interested in how he kind of just pointed to what he described as cracks in the veneer of thoroughness, which I thought was a kind of fantastic turn of phrase, pointing to the cross-examination of forensic scientist Clifton Frost, who we heard a lot from, spent a long time in the witness box. James, what were some of the moments that he came back to with Clifton Frost?
Yeah, so this is the crime scene examiner from the 1999 scene. We were reminded by Travis Jackson that DNA evidence was very much in its early stages and that some of the cross-contamination issues that had stemmed from what was a huge amount of forensic evidence and an extremely messy, in fact, ransacked crime scene, as we've discussed over the various episodes, some of the cross-contamination issues were only revealed as a result of cross-examination on these measures to actually reduce cross-contamination. So really, essentially what he was saying is if we hadn't asked about it, then you wouldn't have known from the brief of evidence, sort of alluding to or asking the jury to perhaps consider how thorough the examinations were at the time and those measures were taken. So we're talking about the gloves, the suits, the booties, those kinds of things. Mm. He also talked to some of the problems with cross-contamination of exhibits at the AFP's examination room in Weston, here in Canberra. This was David Royds, who had not put down paper in between looking at two different exhibits, which is how the tape from the white van, the tradie's white van, ended up having traces of Irma's blood on it, or at least that's what the Crown says is the evidence, and that's the evidence that David Royds gave in terms of that cross-contamination. So really the general point that he was trying to make is, you know, we've had these other issues over here, how can you trust the evidence over here? Really trying to cast that doubt on some of the forensics.
Yeah, and as well as Travis Jackson kind of making his closing statements to the jury on behalf of Joseph Ocone, we also have Skye Jerome, the other defence barrister in this room. She's Steve Fabrizi's barrister. Liz, in her closing statements, she kind of shot out of the blocks quite strongly, didn't she?
Yes, in fact, it was a very strong summing up at the end. She's dwelt on things like what she says was a compromised crime scene. There are a couple of instances of contamination she seized on. One was, of course, the tape from the mysterious white van, which turned out, according to the scientists, to have only dried blood on it, although she said that she didn't think you could rule that out completely. Mm. She also seized on another thing. You remember we talked earlier about the grey squares that they used to give truer colours to the pictures,
mm,
and how that page with the grey square was used in various places around the house. And she suggested that that may have interfered with where various bits of DNA were. But the key bits were things like, she said that there had been a closed-minded investigation which had dwelt on the DNA evidence, and that the current police investigation had not gone into things. For instance, like last time we talked about the third person theory, and the person who had confessed to being there but left before there was any violence, she said that wasn't looked into properly, and that many of that person's associates were never tested for their DNA. Their DNA was never compared to the DNA found in the fridge, for instance, or around the house. So she was quite critical of the prosecution case. And she said that there was no evidence that her client entered the house. Another thing she raised, which is very critical to the main charge these two men are facing, is that the autopsy report was unable to determine an actual cause of death. And she said that that should be fatal to the prosecution case, because she said you can't be found guilty of murder if there's no cause of death determined.
It was interesting the way in which Skydrone talked about the DNA evidence from the point of view of the fridge sample. So this is the milk container that started this whole reinvestigation that identified Steve Fabrizi's DNA. Having been there, she made the point that it could have been transferred there from outside in many different ways. And that even if you do believe that he drank from that milk container, all that proves is that he was at the fridge. Doesn't prove that he did any of the things that the prosecution says that he did, i.e. the violent assaults and the ransacking of the house. Still, the defence is that he was only inside briefly to help Joseph Ocone out of the window when he had hurt himself. So it was interesting the way she walked the jury through the ways in which they could consider reasonable doubts.
Yeah, and I mean, we talked a bit about the way that Trent Hickey used the undercover recording of Steve Fabrizi to kind of point to him, you know, as someone who's lied, you know, highlighting in that interview he lies 17 times. Sky Jerome uses that same piece of evidence and then says that tells a different story. James, what did she highlight and how did she present that information?
Well, sort of in the exact opposite, in short, she said that this shows that his story has been the same all the way through, that, you know, he didn't have to talk to police, but he did. Notwithstanding, he didn't know that UCA Danny was police at the time. I think she was referring to sort of the subsequent police interview and the fact that those stories, broadly speaking, align. Now, that's not what the Crown says, as we've discussed, but still, she essentially, yes, used it the sort of polar opposite way to say that, you know, he can be trusted. He, you know, he's shown remorse. He said in the police interview that, you know, he feels guilt about this. And at one point she said, you know, someone who would go and put a pillow under someone's head is not the act of a merciless killer. That's the act of compassion. So, again, polar opposites from both sides.
Yeah, it's always interesting to hear how the exhibits, you know, the same exhibit or the same piece of evidence is used slightly differently by the barrister, depending on what side they have come from. And we've already spoken about the DNA and how Sky Jerome has challenged that, the questions she's asking, the contamination that we've spoken a lot about. I mean, that was, you know, pretty apparent from the evidence we've heard throughout the trial, the way she's been challenging that. James, how did she kind of wrap all that up and conclude that idea?
Well, obviously the DNA is central to this whole case. If there were lots of numbers in Trent Hickey's closing, there were close to none when it comes to the DNA evidence in Sky Jerome's closing, and for that matter, to a greater or lesser extent, Travis Jackson's too. Obviously, this is really the fulcrum of the entire case. It was more lent on as a, you know, it's a thing that is not certain, notwithstanding the quintillions and so on, and that some of the other comparisons and samples hadn't been made. So it was interesting to note the presence and absence of numbers and those large numbers that we've talked a lot about in both sides.
Yeah. Thank you, James. We are getting very close to the jury basically retiring to consider their verdict. The judge is wrapping up his charge, likely as you're listening to this, if he has not already, as you are enjoying the case of the two intruders. Liz, you know, we've talked a lot about murder. We talked a lot about alternative charges at the top of this episode. Murder is kind of the big consideration for the jury. Is manslaughter something they are able to consider in this if they can't get all the way to murder?
Yes, it is. It's not on the indictment, but the jury has been told by the judge that manslaughter is an option open to them, and it will be the same thing by joint commission, and they are allowed to consider it if they decide that the elements of the murder charge can't be met.
Yeah, thank you, Liz. We have had so many questions coming through to the case of at abc.net.au. We'll be diving into all of them in our upcoming episodes. We'll have the verdict for this as soon as the jury returns with their verdict. So make sure you grab yourself ABC Listen. It is the best place to enjoy episodes of the case of. Liz, what happens now? Are we just sitting and waiting?
When the judge sends the jury out today, we've had 14 jurors, and unfortunately for two of them, they will be what they describe as balloted off. They have a little wooden barrel and they choose the numbers, and then those two people leave after hearing all of this over so many weeks. And then 12 people will be left to decide what the fate of these two men will be.
Thank you. I often wonder what it would be like sitting through all of this evidence and then being told you don't need to do this. And I was talking to Christian Silver, who's been a court reporter in Melbourne for a very long time, and saying, oh, look, are they a bit disappointed? And he said, often they look incredibly relieved that they don't need to make that decision. So Godspeed to the 12 jurors who will be making this decision in the trial of Joseph Ocone and Steve Fabrizi. Unless we have a verdict before next Thursday, that will be your next episode of the case of the two intruders. We'll answer some of your questions if we're still waiting for a verdict at that point. So please get in touch, thecaseof@abc.net.au. We'll have an episode of the case of the Wheelie Bin murder for you on Tuesday next week. As you may have heard from our episode yesterday, there's been a mistrial in that trial. So we'll be answering your questions and exploring yesterday's developments in more detail with Eva Blandis on that one. And we've also had a lot of emails about whether we'll be covering the trial of Ben Robert Smith, who's been charged with war crimes. I can say that is certainly something that we have our eyes on and we'll be looking at doing. That might just be a little while away. We've also had a lot of questions asking if we'll cover the trial of Patrick Stevenson, who's accused of murdering Samantha Murphy in Ballarat. And we are planning to. That trial has been delayed a bit, though. There's some pre-trial hearings underway at the moment that we can't report on, but we'll keep you updated and bring that to you when it gets before a jury. If you're interested in any and all of that, make sure you grab ABC Listen. All of our episodes pop up there slightly before they pop up anywhere else. But if you are listening somewhere else, leave us a rating and a review because it helps other people find us. Liz, James, thank you so much for joining us for this episode and helping us unpack the closings.
Well, thank you.
Thanks, Stocky.
The Case of the Two Intruders is produced by ABC Audio Studios and ABC News. It's reported by Elizabeth Byrne and James Viver and is presented by me, Stephen Stockwell. Our supervising producer is Greg Muller and our executive producer is Claire Rawlinson. Thank you to senior lawyer Jasmine Sims, our legal queen, for her legal advice, and to the ACT Newsroom, and also to Audio Studios manager Eric George. This episode was produced on the land of the Ngunnawal, Ngambri and Wurundjeri people.